I don't know what to say about this introduction, but it did remind me of the Toastmaster at a banquet who got up to introduce the speaker, and he said, "Well, they told me that the speaker needed no introduction, and I'm glad he doesn't because I never heard of him before." Of course, he did say that since he got here Saturday, he began to try to gather a few things, learn a little something to get prepared. He apologized, Lawson apologized for being so unprepared for this introduction. Like the man who came in real excited telling his wife about the shotgun he had just purchased. And he said, honey, I've got a new shotgun and it'll shoot 7 times without loading. She said, "My goodness, how many times will it shoot if you load it?" I don't know. I don't know what he'd have done if he'd have prepared an introduction tonight. Of course, he was introduced as being a sixth quarter dental student. Now, this may be common terminology to you folks, but this sounds like the new math to me because 6 quarters. I can't figure out 6 quarters in anything. Unless it's like that high school boy that came home from school with a quart of milk and a whole apple pie that he brought to his mother to have a little afternoon snack before his evening meal, you know. He sat down at the table and asked his mother to cut the pie for him and bring him a glass. And then he said, "But don't cut the pie in 8 pieces, just cut it in 4 because I don't think I can eat 8 pieces. Well, I'll have to tell you, Lawson, you did a mighty good job. I appreciate the very, very gracious introduction that you gave me, but it wasn't the best introduction I've ever received, I'll tell you that. It wasn't exactly. The best I ever had, I'll have to tell you where it was. It was out in Africa, way, way, way up in the interior of Uganda, last September. And we were way back in the Karamojong territory in a very primitive village, and Webb Carroll, our missionary, was trying to impress upon these Karamojong people the importance of this visitor that had come so far and was there to have this first evangelistic service among them. So he said to the interpreter, he said, "Tell these people that this man is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention." Well, the interpreter just turned around like that. He didn't know what that meant. It didn't mean a thing to him. So Webb Carroll groped a little, and he said, "Tell them Presidente, 33,000 churches, Presidente." Well, again, he didn't understand because they didn't know what one church was, much less 33,000 of them. So then he switched into Swahili and he said, "Bwana Makuba, Bwana Makuba." That means big chief, big chief. He said, "Bwana Makuba, Bwana Makuba, 11 million people, Bwana Makuba." Ah, he got it then. And with great enthusiasm, he turned to the villagers and he said, "Bwana Makuba, Bwana Makuba, big chief, much cattle, many wives." Well, I've only got one. She's here, right back there in the middle. I heard a good story. This hasn't got a thing to do with the message at all, but we're always ready to hear a good story, and I'm always anxious to hear a good one on Texas. Anyway, how many Texans we got here tonight? Oh, look at them. They're proud of it. Look at them. Well, I'll have to tell you about these Texans. You know, in this day of smart pills and memory pills and everything, they've now developed instant brains. You heard about that? So this fellow went into this brain shop to buy some instant brains, and he was pricing them. And here they were, Harvard brains, $500 an ounce. PhD brains, $1,000 an ounce. Nuclear physicist brains, $1,500 an ounce. Texas brains, $5,000 an ounce. Say, yeah, come on. Amen, that's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Fella said, Texas brains, $5,000 an ounce. Tell me, why in the world do these Texas brains cost so much? He said, man, you don't know how many Texans it takes to get an ounce of brains. Yes. Well. You want to take a bow now, Grady? Well, you know, they assigned me a subject tonight. A subject that's even bigger than Texas. I'm going to talk about the world tonight. That's the only thing that's any bigger than Texas, I guess. But I want to, before I talk about this world and our place in it, I want to read to you just a verse or two of scripture here over in the 6th chapter of Isaiah. In the year that the king Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Isaiah had turned aside in his sorrow when his idol, the king, had died. And there in the Lord's house, on the Lord's day, in prayer, by himself, I think, he looked up. He saw the ceiling fade away, and he saw on through, and he saw a vision of God. He saw the Lord on his throne. And when he saw God, he also saw something else. He saw a vision of his people, his nation. And as he saw God and saw his world in which he lived, he saw God weeping and distressed. And he writes, and he says in the 8th verse, and I heard the voice of the Lord as he was saying, and I think maybe wringing his hands, saying, whom shall I send? Whom shall I send? And when Isaiah saw the Lord and saw the world through God's eyes, and heard the call of God saying, whom shall I send? Whom shall I send? He said, I just had to answer back and say, here am I. Send me. Send me. Send me. Tonight I think God is saying to you and to me, what are you going to do in this world of his? Seen a little of it this week. You've seen a little of God this week. You've opened your hearts, you've opened your ears, and you've been gathering day by day and night by night. And now tonight, the question comes, what in the world are you going to do? Well, let's talk a little bit about this world then. Let's see it through God's eyes. This world, what kind of a world is it? It's a world full of people tonight. Oh, people, people, can you see them? 3 billion people in this world. And more with every tick of the clock. Put your finger on the pulse of your wrist here, and with every beat of your pulse, know that 26 more people are being added to this world, just like that as we sit here. 3 billion of them. Now, these are all statistics, and the population explosion is just a statistical figure until you get out there and see these great masses of people. Come with me to the Far East, to that heavily populated part of the world, Japan. Come to Tokyo, the world's largest city. 10 million people sleep there every night. 10 million. But in the daytime, 13 million people are there.
See them, 3 million of them feeding into that city every morning and going back out to sleep elsewhere outside the city at night. Stand down there at that great central station and see them as they take these electric trains. And you know, they have to hire 1,000 students like you every day. Their jobs, they're pushers and pullers, they're called. And they stand down there at the station and they just do one thing. They push people onto those trains and they reach in and pull them off. They pack them on like sardines and push the crowd back and push one more on to take care of these great teeming masses of people that flow through the streets. Oh, see, India with 450 million people. Think of it. Indonesia, 100 million people. China with 600, 700 million people. We don't know exactly. The people of this world, see them. Made in the image of God. Made by God. Made for God. Lost from God. And these people are hungry-hearted people. We can talk about the physical needs. They are physically hungry. 2/3 of them will go to bed tonight hungry. We can talk about their physical ailments. We can talk about the disease. We can talk about their physical needs. We can talk about the housing, the inadequate housing in the slums of Johannesburg or in the slums of Lagos or in the slums of Rio. But let's look at them and see these people as God sees them also. Hungry, empty-hearted people looking for something, seeking something, seeking to fill an emptiness and a void in their heart as they've been plummeted into the 20th century with its scientism and its intellectualism, and suddenly they are casting off all the traditions of yesterday, all the religions of yesterday, all the superstitions of their parents, casting all of this behind them, and suddenly they find themselves empty inside, in a vacuum, a spiritual vacuum, and looking out to find something to lay hold on, something they can believe in, some God to whom they can commit themselves. It's not a godless world we're in. It is not a world void of religion or rebelling against religion. It's a world in transition as it turns from one God and looks for another, as it turns from an old traditional religious faith of yesterday, but groping out to find some new relevant faith that can be adequate in a 20th century of science and intellectualism. For example, over in Japan, stand with me before a great Soka Gakkai temple there. This is one of the new cults of Buddhism, militant Buddhism, marching today. Soka Gakkai started in its move after World War II, just 25 years, but in a quarter of a century, Soka Gakkai now has 10 million members. 10 million believers following this contemporary Buddhism, this new cult, this new religion, this new faith. This is but an expression of what's happening all around this world, the spiritual vacuum in Latin America, where disenchanted with the Catholicism and tradition, the great masses of Latin America are now looking for something to fill their hearts. It's the greatest day of opportunity the Christian faith has ever seen. There are wider open doors and wider open hearts than this world has ever known. As everything of the past is being swept away and people are seeking and searching and hungry-hearted. See this world also as a world in revolution. Physical, violent revolution. Oh, you say you're talking about Vietnam. Yes, there's revolutionary changes taking place there. War, fighting. But there are other places that we don't see in the headlines. But let me tell you some of them. Over there in Indonesia, a little string of islands that we hardly knew existed before the last decade. Yet it's the fifth largest nation in the world, 100 million people there. Let me tell you about the violence in Indonesia. We see the focus of attention on the losses in Vietnam, but since last October in Indonesia, over 3 100,000 people have been killed in the violent revolution that's taking place there. Well, you see, there was an attempted communist coup. This coup failed, and there has been the purging of the population of communists. And just quietly and silently at night, these militant Muslim groups, young people, have slipped in and slit the throats and killed people. 300,000 of them have been killed. Now, if the revolution had gone the other way, if the communist coup had succeeded, it would have been the others, among them our Christians, who would have been slaughtered in such numbers. And I found out when I was in Jakarta that every one of our missionaries over there had had their names on the blacklist. They'd seen the lists prepared by the communists where the Christian pastors were to be executed, the Christian missionaries were to be killed, and the Christian church members were to have their eyes gouged out. It could have gone that way. It went the other way. And there have been 300,000 people killed in Indonesia in the last 9 months. I heard stories of this violence, of how boys were out on a soccer field using human heads for a football as they kicked them around. I heard stories of how they took these headless bodies and skewered them together on long bamboo poles until 6 or 8 bodies were formed into a raft. And then they put a mast in the center of this raft and put a communist flag on it in derision and floated these rafts of human bodies down the streams. This is the world, a world of violence, crime, of killing. But the world I want you to see is still a world that tonight I say is a world in which the living God is at work. And around this world, great, glorious things are happening as our God moves in power. While we talk about the death of God theology, let me talk about the living God at work in His world tonight. For during the past 2 years, I've traveled all over this world, 300,000 miles in these 2 years, and I have seen this living God at work. I have seen His power. I have seen things that convince me tonight that this world does stand on the threshold of a great spiritual renewal and revival. There is the potentiality. There are the factors. There are the negative factors. There's the vacuum out yonder. And then here are the positive forces of Christianity, where great spiritual movements are breaking out around this world, to where I'm convinced tonight that we are on the threshold of a great renewal, a great renaissance, something, I don't know how to describe it, but one of these days it could go down in history as another great reformation, as another great corner that humanity turns. And the glorious thing about it is that you and I are sitting here tonight at this pivotal point in history. Isn't it a great time to be alive, to think that you and I might be able to be a part of this? That we might be able to be the instruments of the living God when humanity turns a corner and a whole new era of human history is ushered in. I believe this is happening. And let me cite to you some of the evidences that I've seen around this world of this living God who is in history, who does have, as Miss Jordan sang a moment ago, He's got this whole world in His hands. It's in His hands, and He's doing something with it tonight. He is. For example, I was down in Brazil, in São Paulo, Brazil, in January. I spoke to the closing session of the Brazilian Baptist Convention. You know where they met? They met out in Pacaembu Stadium. This giant athletic stadium, on a rainy Sunday afternoon, when up here in North America a few drops of rain will keep 1,000 Baptists away. Down there on a rainy Sunday afternoon, with umbrellas in hand, 40,000 people came out to that stadium and sat through 4 hours of preaching and singing and activities, and hundreds of people were saved. These Brazilian Baptists launched a crusade of the Americas, they call it, calling for Baptists of North and South America and Christians from Hudson Bay to Buenos Aires to join in a great hemispheric crusade to win this world to Jesus Christ. This Pockenbue Stadium meeting climaxed 2 years of a convention-wide, nationwide evangelistic crusade. 2 years ago, let me tell you the fantastic story. 2 years ago, Brazilian Baptists, in a country where they're a very small minority, where they're weak, where most of their churches are no larger than the adult Sunday school department in your church, they said, "We're going to march to win Brazil to Jesus Christ. We're going to have stadium meetings and theater meetings and citywide meetings." I went into a city there out of Sao Paulo of 100,000 people, two little Baptist churches. Each of them had 100 members each. And yet those two little Baptist churches went down, rented the theater downtown for a whole week, got television time, radio time, took a census of 100 square blocks downtown, and had a citywide revival, these two little churches with 100 members. And they had more than 200 conversions in this citywide revival that they had. And they caught the attention and the interest of a whole city. Well, that's the sort of thing they did. So they started it back yonder 2 years ago. They had these meetings in the cities. They had their street meetings. They had their door-to-door witnessing. In one state alone, they gave out over 600,000 Bibles from door to door. This sort of thing, church meetings, and all of this. Well, they started with 250,000 church members 2 years ago. Now, let's get it in perspective. 250,000 church members. In these 2 years, they have reported over 100,000 professions of faith in these revivals. They've already baptized more than 60,000 of these 100,000, added them to the church, and there are tens of thousands of these new converts in pastors' classes ready to be baptized now. If Southern Baptists were to have this same kind of renewal and this same kind of an experience, it means that in the next 2 years, we would have 4.5 million people converted, new converts that we'd reach in this culture of ours. That's the dynamics of this thing. Over 300 new churches have been started during this time, and they told me that they have 3,500 preaching stations and missions yet to be organized into churches. They told me that their seminaries were bracing for a doubling of their enrollment in the next 5 years, for they said, "We have had hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of young people who have surrendered their lives to full-time Christian service, church vocational work, and so forth." In the area of Sao Paulo alone, they said, "We have the cards, the commitment cards, on 600 young people in this immediate area who have felt a call to a church-related vocation." That's what's happening there. But that's not an isolated example. This thing that's happened in Brazil is not just a freak. This is happening all over the world, and I've seen it all over the world. That's what this African diary is about. This is a book I had to write. When I came back from Africa, so great had been my impressions there of this spiritual tide that's breaking forth, these eruptions like volcanoes that I saw here and here and here in Africa, that I had to write this. And this book was written during the busy period of the state conventions and so forth last fall, when just in a matter of a few weeks, I put down here for you to read a record of what is happening over there. And I hope every one of you will, if you have to borrow or charge or scrounge around some way, I hope you'll get the story of what's happening in Africa here before you leave. Go over there and get it and read what we're doing over there and how God is using the little bit that we're doing in such a great way over there. Well, let me tell you, for example, over in Ghana. Ghana, this communist country, when I was there — there's since been a revolution, as you know — when I was there, Kwame Nkrumah was the dictator, prime minister. I want you to see what happened in this dictatorship, police state, orientated toward China and Russia, and committed to communism. Certainly you couldn't find a more unfriendly environment, could you, for a spiritual revival to break loose. But that's not the full story. Let's go not only in that country, but also let's go to the Kwame Nkrumah University campus. Now, what is this school? This school was named after the dictator. There's not a more socialist or leftist campus in all of Africa. Staffed by Russian and Chinese technicians, committed to the philosophy of the dictator, Kwame Nkrumah. 1,200 students there, they represented the elite, the intelligentsia, the eggheads of Ghana. That's who they were. So here you have all of intellectualism and all of leftism and all of communism that you could put together in one place in Africa. You had it right there. Now, on this campus was a group, a little handful of Christian students. Now, this little handful of Christian students, ask one of our missionaries who teaches at our seminary there, Dick Henderson, to come over to the campus for a week of religious activities and services. They bathed this meeting in prayer, they committed it to the Lord, and they asked him to come, and they started out in a little tiny room. But as he began to speak and they began to witness, the crowds grew day by day and night by night. Before the week was over, more than 600 of the 1,200 students enrolled there were in attendance. Isn't that fantastic? And when the week was over, more than 200 of these students had made public professions of faith in Jesus Christ. Don't say it can't happen in an intellectual environment, even a hostile intellectual environment, or even in a communist environment. It happened there. And when this thing happened and broke loose on that campus there, it spread. It spread over the city of Kumasi. It spread. They were out in the marketplace witnessing. They were gathering, saying, what can we do now to see this sort of a spiritual revolution take place in Ghana? They followed this with a national crusade. Now, Baptists in Ghana, a very small, weak group. But the Baptist churches and the Ghanaian Baptist Convention united in a crusade, a nationwide crusade. They had that crusade this spring. They had a month of preaching on the streets and in the churches. And there are spectacular stories of what happened. Such stories as they had more converts than they had church members. The total results, they had more people converted than they had at the church base that they began with the month before. But I think the most unusual thing is that the Baptists of Ghana closed this national crusade on Sunday night. And on Monday morning, they had a revolution in Ghana and threw out the dictator. Now, I'm not saying there's any connection between the two, but that's the way it happened. That's the way it happened. This is one of the great victories for democracy. One of the great victories for the Western world. When Nkrumah was thrown out, and Ghana was faced toward the West again. Well, I could go on and on telling you of these fantastic breaking outs that are, well, over Nigeria. Let's go over to Nigeria. Nigeria is where we've been for 115 years with a great mission program. We have a strong Nigerian Baptist Convention with more than 70,000 members in it, and many great, brilliant pastors. And Dr. Dehunse, one of the present president of the Nigerian Baptist Convention, is a graduate of Louisville Seminary and is one of the most brilliant men ever to attend that seminary. Oh, we've got a great convention and a great witness over there. But we just don't get the dimensions of it until you get there. Oh, it was over there 11 years ago, that I met your sister and her husband, who has since gone to be with the Lord, Martha Gilliland, this dedicated sister of Irene Jordan. Martha, over there with those nimble fingers of hers, this skilled physician, one of the best surgeons in the world, whom I understand was offered a high position on a university faculty over here. when she was home on furlough. And they made every offer and every inducement and everything under the sun until they got up to the salary of $25,000, $35,000. Then they said, you write your ticket. We'll pay you anything to stay. And she just simply said, I'm sorry, I have a previous commitment. And the answer came back, well, whatever your commitment is from someone else, we'll do better. And she said, you can't do better. My commitment is to the Lord as a missionary doctor. And she went back to the mission field for $2,000 a year salary. To be a doctor in a little old bush hospital then that didn't even have inside plumbing and running water. But that's where I saw her first 10 years ago. But I was back to Bomashaw this time. Went out to our seminary. 165 students in our seminary there. Dr. Christy Poole, the president of the seminary, says every Sunday, every Saturday, every weekend, these students get on bicycles. They ride out here 60, 50, 40 miles out here to pastor churches. He said, let me tell you about a Bomashaw here, where we've got our hospital, and we've got this seminary, and we had a leper colony out here, and we've had to work here a long time. He said, there are 1 million people here in this circle of 25 miles, 1 million people. Guess how many Baptist churches and missions we have in here?